a cancer surgeon, urologic cancer surgeon who does cancer research would be talking about this topic, and I hope by the time I finish you'll understand at least a little bit of why I might deserve to be up here. Of course, one of the reasons is because many of us physicians, Christian physicians, from Monday to Saturday we treat the body as a machine. And then on Sunday, many of us squirm in our pews when the congregation prays for healing. And of course, there are many questions related to this. What is the purpose of PFH, prayers for healing? Should physicians react to patients who rely totally or partially on PFS? Should physicians ask to, or should they pray with their patients? And there's been a lot of literature on that. What should physicians think about the efficacy of prayers for healing? The current research on intercessory prayer, we know a little bit about that. But what is the hope for efficacy? Is it psychosomatic? Do we change the laws of biology and the universe? Or something else? So I'm going to, sort of unfortunately, have to tell you a little bit about my background so that you kind of understand where I'm coming from.
We can move this on.
Okay. Then I'm going to read you an encounter that hopefully will explain even more why I'm here. And then I'll tell you what my current activity is with physicians and fellows, residents, medical students with PFSH. And I'm not going to talk about the placebo effect, the research on intercessory prayer, and related topics. I'm a genetic Lutheran. Most of my uncles and cousins are Lutheran pastors and teachers, and my father was a theologian of sorts and ended his career at Valparaiso, and I went to a secular university, and of course, more for effect than conviction. I came back and said I was an atheist. He gave me mere Christianity. And because I'd met people like Martin Marty, Paul Tillich, etc., I didn't throw out the baby with the bathwater, obviously came back. But I became very intrigued, if not passionate, about several facts. One, most pastors and people in theology knew almost nothing about science. They'd taken almost no science courses. And more importantly, the scientists and physicians that I had run through at my NIH, at Duke, and various other places, knew almost nothing about religion or philosophy, other than what they may have learned in Sunday school, Hebrew school, etc. And in fact, I'll never forget the first time I realized this was when I was a freshman and taking my first my neuroanatomy test, and the professor, enterprising man, instead of saying, "What's that?" which is the pineal body, said, "What famous philosopher called that the seat of the soul?" And over 80% of the class, and this is one of the top medical schools in the country, never heard of Descartes. And that sort of got me on a path, and many years later, I complained about the lack of science education to the head of religion at Valpo. Next thing, I was on this program with some pretty heavy hitters, Gail Mylander, who was on the president's committee, a conservative ethicist, and Ted Peters, who subsequently became a patient and also a friend. And I was rather scared at talking about Christianity and the reproductive genetic revolution. But afterwards, two things happened that I never forgot. One, many of the science professors came up and said, "Boy, I'm so glad you said that. I wish I could have said that." And then the second thing, I said, "Well, you know, I'm just a plumber. I'm not too sure I need to be up here with these heavy hitters." And they said, "Oh, no. You need to be here because you see death." And, of course, what I realized is that most physicians don't see death. They see a broken machine hooked up to a bunch of machines. I actually do, as a cancer surgeon, took the time and trouble to, if you want to call it that, to hold the hand of over 60 patients and saw the light go out. And something almost everybody saw many times several generations ago. And it does take your breath away occasionally. So I thought, well, maybe I did have something to say. Subsequently, I got the money from CTNS and from the Templeton Foundation and others, $100,000, and we tried, with some success, to increase the dialogue between science and religion at the University of Washington. And we brought Ted Peters there for his campus-wide lecture, and I received an awful lot of flack from that, from some of our atheist professors who, the year before, just fawned over Daniel Dennett. I thought that was interesting. Because I work in the world of molecular biology, was involved in a society called the Lady Lodge Society. I got to meet Francis Collins, got involved in ASA because of that, and eventually by a logos, and in fact went to their, the privilege to go to their second meeting. And in the meantime, at various places and churches, usually on Sunday, I would begin to give more and more lectures on the five big questions of life, which you all heard. Where we come from, who are we, what should we do while we're here, what are we going to do after we die, and are these questions worth asking? And usually what I do, instead of trying to convince, I show them the sophisticated world of science and religion, which you all know here, and show them some books and read some quotes. Here is, in fact, what we're doing now at the University Presbyterian Church, where I'm a member. And as you see, number five, I'm going to be giving soon, which is somewhat in an hour, what I'm going to try to convey to you. And we also have others, in fact, the head of astronomy there, a rather world-famous neurobiologist, et cetera, who are Christian, will be talking also. But let me tell you, in about 8 minutes, why this subject about God's mind came to pass. And what happened is I operated on a patient. Then we went on rounds with medical students and fellows and residents, etc. We went into the room, and we came out, and I wrote an essay. Here's what I'm going to describe it to you. This is what I wrote and gave to them. 2 weeks ago, we operated on a man with prostate cancer. We'll call him Mr. Jones, who had very bad preoperative parameters, and I feared that there'd been many positive pelvic nodes, and I would simply have to open and close. And we both knew that that would be a bad prognostic event. However, when I explored him, it wasn't that bad. I was able to do a radical prostatectomy. And that evening, on rounding with all of these people, I told Mr. Jones the good news. And he replied, "Doctor, I knew it because I had 1,000 people praying for me. As often happens in those situations, behind me I could sense the few snickers and rolled eyes of the residents and students, much as they would have if a patient had extolled the benefits of some mysterious potion obtained from Mexico." Later, outside the room, we crowded around for a little teaching rounds, and suddenly one of the residents knew I was a Christian, said, "Dr. Lang, do you really believe that?" I responded that what he was really asking was not the fact that because this man knew he had many people praying for him, including himself, that knowledge probably would help him face his crisis, and possibly through mechanisms which we still don't understand, make the physiological response to his illness better. We're still struggling to reliably measure this effect, but most of us believers and non-believers, that believers in whatever religious view do better mentally and probably physically in handling disease. In that sense, prayer does work, and most of us believe that. No. What the resident really wanted to know was, do I believe, because he and his friends prayed for the good outcome, that the disease in his body suddenly changed for the better? Does God change his mind? I responded, yes, I do believe that. But instead of ending it there, I would sit down and limiting myself to 2 hours, so it wouldn't be somewhat of a term paper, I would write down and then give to them why I believe believe in prayer in something more than a psychophysiologic feel-good phenomenon. So here I go. It actually took me a little longer than 2 hours because I had to type it out. Before I talk specifically about God changing his mind, let me comment on two aspects of prayer that are related. First, I believe in prayer and pray regularly because God told us to pray. This is not a cop-out or a mindless obedience of a ritualistic believer. Rather, it is the center of this issue. I believe in God and the testimony of the Scriptures as a relatively accurate and testable approximation of his character and will. I believe it is based on what is often called faith. I like to think of it as a leap, a commitment to a worldview based on some evidence, but it's still ultimately a leap, or as Pascal expounded, a wager. Who can really know? So you might as well bet on God and his message, because if you lose nothing, but if you win, you gain it all. Ultimately, all the medicine one can assemble concerning the existence or non-existence of God, or purposeful world or not, or a God that is involved in the world and has communicated some of his attributes of love for us in documents handed down through the ages, etc., etc., it does become a leap into the unknowable, and either toward God or to something else that is equally based on faith, such as that what science tells us is all there is, so-called scientism. I think it was St. Augustine who said, "I believe so that I can understand rather than I understand so I can believe." I think that's an overstatement, but it's more true than not. In fact, the quote is easier to understand today because of a philosophical process called deconstructivism. I don't believe in that school totally, but what it did do, for one, is to show scientists that they were not so pure when it comes to making nothing but faith, nothing on faith, that they take nothing on faith. Indeed, many of the things that they did and are doing that seem very scientific are based on assumptions that they take for granted because of many factors surrounding them in their lives. Another aspect of prayer outside the main point here is that we mostly pray not to ask God to do what we want, but to place us, to help us place ourselves in His hands, believing, as He promised, that all work will work out for the best. The benefit of that attitude, believing in some higher purpose, is obvious, and as previously stated, almost certainly has some physiologic advantage, which someday will be scientifically measured and understood. But it is much deeper involved. Using prayer to move away from an egocentric view toward a more selfless state produces a peace that is a mystery, so-called surpasses all understanding, that many wise men, especially the mystics of many religions, have described in very believable but profound terms. But now to the main point. Does God's mind, and does it change when I pray? Incidentally, what we're really talking about here is divine action. And I was shocked to find that once I looked, there were a host of learned books on the subject, often written by scholars extremely well-versed in both theology and science. For example, on my desk at home were five very thick volumes published by the Vatican Observatory and a wonderful organization at UC Berkeley called CTNS, as you all know. And the titles of these books are Quantum Cosmology and Laws of Nature, Scientific Perspectives on Divine Action, Evolutionary Biology, Scientific Perspectives on Divine Action, Chaos and Complexity, et cetera, Neuroscience in the Person, Quantum Physics and Quantum Field Theory. I must admit that I only partly through these tomes, which I only incompletely understand, but I have a better sense of the legitimacy of rational inquiries into divine action, and it's reassuring. That is, I now appreciate that many people who know the score believe debate about divine action is relevant, and many, and great many of these people believe in it. However, I promised to tell you my own thoughts and not a term paper, so here goes. Of course, I don't know, but it seems to me that God's mind, the fundamental laws of nature, do not change, just our understanding of them. Certainly so far, whenever strange things are observed in and out of medicine, things that heretofore and even now are called miracles, always scientific scrutiny, when capable of comment, have found that these things follow natural laws or at least widely agreed descriptions. For example, in medicine, medical descriptions of seemingly fatal cancers have a wide range of possibilities, ranging from extremely virulent to a somewhat protracted courses and even rarely spontaneous cures, which we euphemistically call the freak rate, to dismiss our ignorance of what's really going on. But always we have the confidence that eventually these freak occurrences will be understood. We never consider them miracles. I certainly have not seen a miracle in my medical career, and I don't know of a physician who has. Yet actually, as a scientist, it's much easier to believe in divine action than it was when the worldview was static. That is, the view that the world was created in toto once and for all and governed by infallible, consistent laws. Now we see a much different universe, one that started with the Big Bang, has a history and geography that positions our world and mankind, that evolved over eons of time into very small place and time, black holes, dark matter, time travel, string theory, with unfathomable dimensions now exceeding 11, and many facts that make intelligent life in the cosmos probable. Taken together, this real world is much more unfathomable than Eve from a rib, water into wine, or resurrection. No wonder physicists concerned with matters related to cosmology are so now filled with wonder that they appear spiritual. So where does divine action fit in this strange world? I don't know exactly, but the point is it can fit, and much better than our former scientific worldview. For example, time is now known to be relative, and a God unconstrained by time seems more plausible. As such, what looks like a miracle within the constraints of time, outside time, seems much more understandable. Thus, Mr. Jones' freak rate cancer and the prayers for and by him could make perfect rational sense when there is no before or after. Another example of our realization that the world, especially the quantum world, is open-ended evolving, merging. It is not totally predictable even by God. This easy allows God to be inside in addition to outside. Thus, a God that is involved in our life is much easier to imagine. Incidentally, the idea that God participates in this evolving, he is so-called emptying himself. The position is called kenosis. It's a stimulating word of considering God and is increasingly utilized by many theologians. Some call it process theology. Many believe, and I guess I do too, that such a view of God, incomplete as must be, helps reconcile differences, many difficulties in religion, including the problem of evil. I could go on rambling about these ideas that I've been exposed to, but I can only completely articulate it. Of course, I feel I know more than I can express. My point is that one learns about the very sophisticated interface between science and religious concerns, the more one realizes that much of religious faith is approachable rationally. Thus, the more I examine and experience, the stronger my convictions that lead toward faith is just as legitimate for those who live and function in the world of science as a leap away from it. Also, a God that can appear to institute miracles, answer prayers, love us, and not yet break the laws he set up is a much more awesome God than one that is constantly rearranging the universe based on this or that, often contradictory, entreaty. My time is up. I wish I had more, but hopefully I've given you a sense of my current thoughts, which I trust every year will make these ruminations increasingly naive. So I gave this to all the people that were outside that room, and I actually have read this at more than once at church, and the last time was in 2002. I said, I wrote this piece in 2002, or I wrote it in 2000. That's 6 years ago, and my faith journey has, I hope, become deeper, if not quieter. And yes, this piece now seems a little naive. Mr. Jones continues to do well. He thinks God changed his mind. I don't. Yet we both continue to fold our hands to the same God and awe his creation in humility and his love, in thankfulness and hope for his grace and in Jesus' name. So, I got a fairly significant response to that thing that I circulated. And many medical students actually wanted to know more. So we have now done, I don't know, 4 or 5 of these 3 to 4 hour sessions in churches, the department library. Some of them are Muslim, Asian, and Hindu. In the next 10 minutes, I'm going to quickly take you through what I've done. First of all, I point out that my purpose is not to sort of shove things down your throat, but merely to show books, and I show them various books. They love to see these books and actually touch them, and to read certain quotes. I can't do that here. I point out that for most of us, but not all, you know, a surgeon can't be totally contemplative. When they've got a big hole in the vena cava, you've got to show it shut, not sit there and think about the ontology or epistemology of a hole in the vena cava. But they do have this feeling of cognitive dissonance. And I tell my goal, that's my favorite cartoon that I put into this picture, which is myself helping one of my junior residents years ago, who now is actually dean at Irvine. His name was Ralph Klim. Ralph, do you understand it now? No. But I'm now confused on a higher plane, which, of course, is Corinthians 13:11, and of course should be your goal, to be confused on a higher plane. I point out the Templeton Prize. I point out and describe various people who really know the score, although most are physicists. I also point out others who have not won the Templeton Prize, including Francis Collins, people I know, and Phil Hefner of Zygon, and of course Robert Russell and Ted Peters, both of which are now friends and actually were my patients at one point. I point out Jennifer Weissman. I point out Counterbalance. I point out other sites, including our own, and other more new sites, and even somewhat hesitantly, Michael Dowd's Evolutionary Christianity site. I point out, and many of them do, in fact, used to buy Ted Peters' book, but now I think I'm recommending Carl Gilbertson and Francis Collins' book as a better one to start out with. And unfortunately, now these people, you know, never heard of Descartes. So when I talk about metaphysics, I have to be a little careful. And we talk about it, and I explain that it's really, you know, it can become complicated, and it doesn't take you very long before you and I majored in philosophy, but get pretty confused, but that they somewhat understand the scientific process and the metaphysical leap, the scientism. I point out several people, including Popper and Kuhn, and to show that there are limits to what in fact can be known scientifically, and that we are subject to prejudice as others. I point out that religion in many ways is the same sort of approach, and there are certain metaphysical leaps, including, for one, inerrancy and literacy and literalism. I point out the various methods in which science and religion have been thought to exist or not exist together, and you know them all, and I emphasize and show many quotes from Ian Barber and his integration model. And I point out that most of these people, at least in part, aspire to so-called critical realism. The philosophical view in science and religion that asserts that our knowledge in the world refers to things the way they are, but are only in a partial fashion that necessarily must be revised. And I give a few quotes, and I can't possibly show you them all. Ian Barber's quote, you know, John Paul, science purifies religion. Purify science from idolatry and false absolutes, and sort of the Einstein one is religion without science is lame, science without religion is blind. Polkinghorne, science is never the end of the story because science cannot tell people what they need to know most, the meaning of life and how to value it. Science is only gives us how without knowing whether. And then, of course, Ted Peters, religion is forged millennia ago to make it relevant in the age of atoms and DNA. Religion must incorporate knowledge gained from natural sciences, etc. And they like that. I point out, and more so now, the so-called militant atheists and their particular scientific reductionist view that religion is evil. And I point out that even his friends have disagreed with him. And they love this quote. And I do too. Well, Dawkins considers that all faith is blind faith and that Christians and Muslim children are brought up to believe unquestionably. Not even the dim-witted clerics who knocked me around in grammar school thought that. For mainstream Christianity, reason, argument, and honest doubt have always played an integral role in belief. Reason, to be sure, doesn't go all the way down for believers, but it doesn't for the most sensitive, civilized, non-religious types either. Even Richard Dawkins lives more by faith than by reason. We hold many beliefs that have no impeachable rational justification, but nonetheless reasonable to entertain. And then I point out the variety of books against the new atheists. I happen to like John Hawke's particular book. I show him this slide, which they know pretty much and got from Jennifer Weissman. And we go into quantum mechanics, which they know a little bit, and I'm glad I don't have to explain it. And I point out that the cosmos is not only awesome, but the cosmos is weird. More weird than water into wine. And then we go into evolution. I used to recommend Ted Peters' book on the new creation, but now the language of God, of course, is something I think is a little better. And we talk about the various categories, and I certainly emphasize theistic evolution, many of which these medical students, etc., are shocked that there is even such a category out there because, of course, they've seen what's on the Trinity Channel, etc., and don't know. And they love the anthropic principle, which I point out, and they particularly love this quote, particularly in Seattle. The probability of life arising on Earth by purely random chance is less than the probability that a flight-worthy Boeing 747 should be assembled by a hurricane roaring through a junkyard. And, of course, we talk about the God of the gaps. And we bring out, Michael Brugger's three possible non-God of the gaps. Why is there something rather than nothing? Why is the world comprehensible? And why is there meaning and value in everything that exists? But then we get to the essential question, which is the leap. Is the cosmos rational or not? And the various positions. And the other leap, which is what every scientist must think. How did it happen if there's no God? Or how did God do it? And, of course, we talk about Pascal's wager, and we talk about this famous quote you all know from Jaspero about the scientists meeting theologians on a mountain. And we talk a little bit about natural theodicy, and we also talk, which they really, really focus on, because this is, of course, one of the things that turns them off the most, which is religion is evil. We bring out Ernest Becker's tribalism, etc. But this is the one quote that usually stops them. When the Centralia High School band plays Beethoven's Ninth, it's not Beethoven's fault. But of course, it's a miracle that they can try. We talk about the faith of the physicists and we get into kenosis, and they love this quote. We tend to think that we are in charge of creation, that we keep all things and throw away the bad, but the world cannot be divided that way. Considering genetic mutation that has been driven the imagined futile history of life on the earth, especially turning bacteria into human beings, genetic mutation is great good, but the same process allows cells to become malignant. You can't have the fruitfulness of evolution without cancer. And finally, after all that, because they don't know about Descartes, we get into special divine action and talk about prayer. And then, in ways, I point out that prayer is not just to reverse fortune, healing, to get what you want, but it's altruism, it's companionship, it's trust, and it's in abandonment and it's engagement. And then we talk about Nolan and the various types of healing, and the fact that most of the studies have shown that the healing that has occurred is primarily in the autonomic nervous system, and depression, the progressive cancer, etc. Freak rape is a little problem, although we do talk about psychoneuroimmunology. And we give a quote from the American Cancer Society, which hopefully you all know, but I don't want to read it right now. And we talk about this, and you all know this, that as we've learned more about force at a distance, that the same chemistry of inorganic is the same as organic, and that life forms have a value, that the same thing may be going on in divine action, although always is the possibility that it's supernatural or gaps. That God could do anything he wants, but did he break the laws, or are we just ignorant of them? We talk about the books I told you about. I happen to recommend this one, which is a summary of all the various things that have occurred. And many of them actually have picked it up and read it. And then we talk about the current theories, which have been talked about, which is the interventional theories, both gaps without causal joint and gaps with causal joint. I must admit that without causal joint, I spend most of my time on panentheism, and I have a little problem totally relating Peacock's view, and I'm very glad that I have quotes to read from it. And we also talk about nonlinear systems, the ones of Pokinger and Murphy, with chaos and complexity and non-reductive physicalism, quantum mechanics, which you've heard about, of Russell and Ellis, and then the process theology of Whitehead and Hawke. And we talk about how God can act within the laws because they're open-ended. Finally, and I emphasize this, again, you must realize that this is over usually 2 to 3 hours of things, that I point out that scientism isn't convincing, that there is one truth but always tentative, that religion is susceptible to human weakness, but it is not a delusion or an evolutionary trick, and that divine action is scientifically plausible and prayers for healing useful in many ways that could be understandable. And I end up with this, that as your struggle with science and religion continues, and it will, because you're always confused on a higher plane. In addition to intellectual vigor, there's awe and wonder, humility, curiosity. And I then show this picture, which they all relate to. It's the country doctor, which most medical students and residents have seen many times. And I bring out Corinthians 13 about love. And because this is a somewhat pluralistic audience often, I often show this quote. It does give me a little problem sometimes, but in case your Arabic is not as good as some of the people that I teach, this is the quote from an Arabic imam in the 13th century. And that's kind of what I've done now in the last, I think we've done this 4 or 5 times, and we seem to have even more and more people asking to hear more about it. And I think it's working. Although, as I said, many of these people never heard of Descartes, and some of them don't care. Thank you.